Welcome to SCOTUScast, Non-Delegation Doctrine Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 8, 2014, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Department of Transportation v. Association of American Railroads. The question in this case is whether the Passenger Rail Investment and Improvement Act of 2008 unconstitutionally delegates legislative power to a putatively private entity, Amtrak, by involving it in the creation of standards used to determine whether freight railroads are according the preference to Amtrak's passenger trains that is required by federal law regarding the use of rail lines. To discuss the case, we have Professor Alexander Sasha Volokh, who is an associate professor of law at the Emory University School of Law. Professor Volokh received his JD and PhD in economics from Harvard University. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Volokh.
Okay, today I'm going to be talking about this case, Department of Transportation v. Association of American Railroads, which was just heard by the Supreme Court on Monday, December 8th. This is an interesting case because it involves the constitutional doctrine known as the non-delegation doctrine, which rarely comes up, and it is a topic of some academic interest for people like me who teach constitutional law and administrative law, but it's sort of been dormant for a long time. So when a case about the non-delegation doctrine comes up, then that's automatically interesting because it's unusual. In addition, this involves the intersection of the non-delegation doctrine and privatization. There's the ability of Congress to delegate power to private actors, and that also lines up with my scholarly interests. So this is in many ways an interesting case for me, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So first, this will require a fair amount of background. We have to understand what Amtrak is and how Amtrak works. So this case is all about Amtrak's relationship with other railroads. Now, Amtrak, its formal name is the National Railroad Passenger Corporation, and that was created by statute in 1970. So before that, there were various railroads that were offering passenger service, but they were incurring heavy losses because they were competing with other modes of transport. And many of the railroads had petitioned the Interstate Commerce Commission, which existed at the time, and it was regulating railroads. They had petitioned the ICC for permission to stop providing passenger service because by statute, railways had these common carrier responsibilities to transport passengers, but they didn't want to do that anymore because they were losing money. So when the Amtrak statute was passed in 1970, this allowed a railroad to transfer its passenger service responsibilities to Amtrak, which was great for the railroad, and the railroad had to agree to a number of conditions. And one condition was to grant Amtrak the use of its tracks and other facilities. And so according to the statute, except in an emergency, an Amtrak passenger car has precedence over another railroad's freight car when they both need to use the same facilities. Most railroads did agree to those conditions, and these conditions were enshrined in a series of bilateral operating agreements between Amtrak and various railroads. Okay, so that was in 1970, and now, many years later, 2008, Congress passes the Passenger Rail Investment and Improvement Act. And one section of that statute, Section 207, is trying to solve this particular problem that supposedly sometimes railroads are not properly giving the required precedence to Amtrak cars, and as a result, Amtrak cars are sometimes being late and so on. So that's contrary to the statute, but it was hard to enforce. So Section 207 of the statute requires Amtrak and the Federal Railroad Administration jointly to, and I'm quoting now from the statute, the section requires the Federal Railroad Administration and Amtrak to, quote, jointly develop new or improve existing metrics and minimum standards for measuring the performance and service quality of intercity passenger train operations. So Amtrak and the Federal Railroad Administration have to develop metrics and standards for measuring performance and service quality. And what are some of those metrics and standards? They can include, the statute lists a number, on-time performance and minutes of delay, ridership, onboard services, stations, facilities, equipment, and other services. Now, these performance measures are actually very significant because Amtrak and its contractual partners, that is, in these bilateral operating agreements, are required to incorporate these measures into the agreements to the extent practical. We don't know exactly what to the extent practical means, but presumably more than zero. So these measures ultimately have to make their way into these contracts. And if Amtrak's on-time performance or service quality is substandard for two consecutive quarters, that's bad. And the Surface Transportation Board, and that's an independent agency housed in the DOT, the Surface Transportation Board is allowed to start an investigation to check whose fault it is and can assess damages against the host railroad if the problems are because the railroad failed to grant preference to the Amtrak trains. So what we have here is Amtrak and the Federal Railroad Administration have to develop these performance standards, and these performance standards really have a bite. They have to some extent, get incorporated into contracts, and then they can be the basis for an investigation and for damages against particular railroads. Now, the thing about Amtrak and the FRA, they have to develop them jointly. What does that mean? They both have to agree. Either party has a veto power over the development of metrics and standards, and the statute provides that if they can't agree, then they can petition the STB to appoint an arbitrator whose decision is going to be binding. So Amtrak has equal authority with the Federal Railroad Administration. Now, why is this important? Because Amtrak is kind of a strange animal because, on the one hand, in some ways, Amtrak looks public because Amtrak is run by a bunch of government officials, presidential appointees, and so on. And also, Amtrak is mostly owned by the federal government. But at the same time, the Amtrak statute says that Amtrak is not an agency and that Amtrak is supposed to run itself like a profit-making entity. So it has certain things that look public, and it also has certain things that look private about it. So you might say, look, Amtrak has some pretty serious regulatory power. It has the power to create these standards, which can become the basis for damages judgments against particular railroads. And these are railroads with which it's kind of competing, and this power is being given to a private entity. And possibly one might think that there's something unkosher about that. So that's how this case arises. The Association of American Railroads challenged this statute, Section 207, because they said that Congress has given up some of its regulatory power to a private organization, Amtrak, and that violates the non-delegation doctrine, and that also violates the Due Process Clause. Now, the non-delegation doctrine, that is a doctrine that has its origin in Article 1, Section 1, the vesting clause, that all legislative power is vested in a Congress. And so that's been interpreted to mean that Congress can't give up its legislative power. Whenever it gives up power, it has to state some kind of intelligible principle. And as long as it states an intelligible principle, it can delegate power, but that's not legislative power. But if it omitted an intelligible principle entirely, then essentially it's delegating the power, and then that delegate gets to make law. And that, doctrine says, is no good. In practice, it's fairly easy to meet this test. That is, Congress can say all sorts of very vague things, like an agency must act reasonably, and that sort of vague language has been held to satisfy the non-delegation doctrine, but it still is a certain limit, even if not a very strong limit. So one argument was that Congress has invalidly delegated power to this private entity, and the other argument is just a due process clause argument that because this entity is profit-making, it is competing with the other railroads, that it has a conflict of interest, and that itself is a violation of due process. Now, the D.C. Circuit, the panel with Judge Janice Rogers Brown writing the opinion, agreed that this was unconstitutional. And the D.C. Circuit panel took what I think is an unusual step, is they said that we're going to rest this opinion on the non-delegation doctrine entirely. They dropped a footnote saying there are arguments that maybe the due process clause and so on, but we don't really see that the inquiry would be any different. So we're just going to resolve this under the non-delegation doctrine. And so under the non-delegation doctrine, Judge Brown wrote that generally speaking, if Congress is delegating to a government agency, it has to provide an intelligible principle. But that's only if Congress is delegating to a public agency. Judge Brown wrote that if Congress is delegating to a private party, then that is per se illegal. That is a per se violation of the non-delegation doctrine, and not even an intelligible principle suffices to save that. I think that's unusual. I think that's contrary to Supreme Court precedent, and I think it relies on a misreading of a case from 1936, Carter v. Carter Cole, which Judge Brown read as a non-delegation case, but which I believe was a due process case, really. But in any event, that's what the D.C. Circuit panel held, that this delegation was per se invalid because it was a delegation to a private party, Amtrak. Now, that's fine so far, but then you have to establish that Amtrak really is private. And as I've said before, Amtrak has some things that look public about it and some things that look private about it. One of the problems is that there are previous cases that have said that Amtrak is actually a state actor for purposes of the First Amendment and therefore for various other constitutional rights like equal protection and due process and so on. There's a case called LeBron, which said that in a First Amendment case, Amtrak had to be considered as part of the government. So that's potentially a problem for someone who wants to say that Amtrak is private. But that's okay because the D.C. Circuit panel wrote that you don't have to be the government for all purposes. You could be the government for purposes of the First Amendment, but private for purposes of the non-delegation doctrine. And so let's look at what the non-delegation doctrine is about. And so, for example, the statute directs that Amtrak has to be run as a profit-making entity and defines the Amtrak as being not an agency and in various ways seeks to insulate Amtrak from political accountability. So the D.C. Circuit panel wrote that from a functional perspective, it makes sense to treat Amtrak as being private for purposes of the non-delegation doctrine. So that was basically the reasoning, that Amtrak is private. Congress has delegated regulatory power to Amtrak, and that delegation is per se illegal. Not even an intelligible principle would be good enough because there's a per se ban on delegations to private parties under the non-delegation doctrine. So I'm an amicus in this case. I filed a brief saying that I think the reasoning is wrong because I don't think that there is or should be any rule against delegating to private parties. But I do think that potentially the D.C. Circuit got it right for the wrong reason, which is that I actually find the due process analysis very compelling because I think that if Amtrak is supposed to be a profit-making entity, then essentially the statute is requiring Amtrak to screw over its competitors whenever possible, much like any competitor is supposed to do. So, and I think that giving a kind of regulatory power to be used in self-interested ways does violate the Due Process Clause. And that's what I argued in my amicus brief, which is that the delegation analysis in the D.C. Circuit opinion is wrong, but that either the Supreme Court ought to remand so the D.C. Circuit can consider the due process analysis, which might come out exactly the same way, or my preference is that the Supreme Court would just decide the due process analysis all by itself. In any event, that's where the case stands, and I really look forward to seeing how this comes out, because whichever way it does, it probably will have very interesting things to say about the intersection of non-delegation and privatization.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org /multimedia.